Yeah. We have a piece of two-dimensional insulator, like mercury telluride, and the edge is gapless. There are two edge modes, and we open a gap in two ways, by a superconductor and by a ferromagnet, by the proximity effect to those two things. And I claim that there is an unpaired Majorana mode at this triple point. And Charlie Kane independently came to the same conclusion, and he'll tell you also about this. Let me go back and let me try to explain why it is an unpaired Majorana mode. And I want to go back to the basic example of a Majorana chain, where we have a set of Majorana modes, and this is a very simple and useful picture. They can form dimers, and if the dimer pattern is like that, there are two unpaired Majorana modes at the end. And this is the tight binding Hamiltonian. But the same Hamiltonian can be obtained in the limit where the two coupling constants are equal. Then we have two gapless modes propagating in the opposite directions, eta 1 and eta 2. And we can add a mesh term representing the difference between the two couplings. And this is the full Hamiltonian. There is a Dirac term and a mesh term. And in this situation, there is an unpaired mode. And this example is basically the same thing, only slightly more complicated. Here we have one fermion. It's a Dirac fermion propagating to the right, another Dirac fermion propagating to the left. And there is a magnetic term, Hx, that flips the spin, and there is also a superconducting term, superconducting gap. And there are many ways to solve this problem. I prefer to use a basis where matrices are real, and so I introduce these combinations of the fields. These are self-adjoint apparatus, so we get the Hamiltonian in this form, where the gamma matrix is very simple. It's the Dirac matrix. And the mass term anti-commutes with the gamma. And so we need to make sure that the mass term for this part of the system and that part of the system belong to different topological classes. And one can easily see that they do belong to different classes, because the topological invariant, there is a Z2 invariant characterizing the edge. It is the determinant of this matrix in the corner. And the mesh term always has this structure, this block diagonal structure, because it anticommutes with the gamma matrix. And the determinant of that matrix changes sign. That's it.
So where is the other Majorana fermion?
Well, if we continue this superconductor and the ferromagnet, so that they touch at a different at another point, that will be the other Majorana fermion.
But in this geometry?
This geometry, it's kind of distributed along this edge.
So during morning's talk, people have asked what happens if you rotate the ferromagnetic direction or change the superconductor phase.
So this change depends only on delta, so I guess it doesn't depend on delta.
It's relative to what? Well, but magnetization is a vector, right? So there are two possible mass terms that you can introduce to the one-dimensional case, right?
Yeah, Hz doesn't open the gap, so there's Hx and Hy.
Yeah,
yeah,
that's rotating between Hx and Hy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know what happens.
I mean, it may change the state, but
yeah, change the way.
It's a triplet superconductor, not a single superconductor.
No, it's actually
superconductor. It says
it's P.
No.
Sorry, okay, this one. It's talking about the other example.
But so maybe the easier question is the phase.
Yeah.
There's only one, you know, phase, it doesn't make sense to talk about a phase. It only makes sense to talk about phase differences. There's only one phase, so there's no, so nothing can depend on phase.
No, it's a non-trivial question, actually. Because what I have checked, if we rotate the superconducting phase delta, we change delta continuously, and
if you compare it to what it was before, then there's meaning to it.
So time dependence of
things. Sure, yeah. Sure, of course.
Yeah. And in this case, so if it's a magnet, then superconductor, and magnet again. And we dial the phase, changing it by 2 pi corresponds to transporting a fermion from one place to the other.
You're changing the direction of the magnetization.
No, the phase of the superconductor.
Right now I'm talking about the superconductor, but I suppose with the magnet it will be the same, because
there's a pumping phenomenon.
Right.
Absolutely. Right.
Alexei, perhaps you remember all the trouble we had with spin injection. Now, if you from a ferromagnet into a semiconductor, simply because of a difference in Fermi energy, that would be an experimental problem in getting this device going. Did you ever consider that in connection with this drawing here? I mean, if I don't have to worry about it, if the Majorana just turns up at this interface between the superconductor and the ferromagnet, then it's way easier to do the experiments. But if I have to worry as well about this impedance and really getting a good contact between the spin of the ferromagnet and the spin in the edge channel, then life gets difficult.
And somehow you're putting it.
Well, sometimes to open a spin gap at the edge. Mm-hmm. This can be done by a magnetic field or by exchange coupling. I don't know what is actually better.
It's a much, much more mundane problem. It has to do with different in the number of electrons and different in Fermi energy between the metal and the semiconductor.
So you're saying that the exchange coupling might not be very big, is that?
Yeah, probably in your language, yes. What I'm saying is that if you just have a metal, this is another contact with a semiconductor S channel, you won't find any spin into it. And my question is, is that a problem?
By metal, you mean the superconductor?
The ferromagnet.
Oh, the ferromagnet doesn't need to be a metal. Actually, it shouldn't be metal, because otherwise there will be gapless modes. I want to eliminate any gapless modes.
You want the ferromagnet to open up a gap.
Yeah.
So I'm not trying to inject spin.
Okay. I mean, as long as you don't want that, then I might even get away with the metal. As soon as you want to inject spin,
No. We're just using the field. Well, in your experiment, you apply the field.
Yeah.
This is just field. If you could locally apply field, then everybody would be equally happy.
Fine. Okay.
Yeah. But for the superconductor, that might be a problem, because the interface might not be good, and the induced gap might be too small.
There could be a short key and whatever.
Yeah.
So in case when you are varying the phase of the superconductor, that configuration you have written on the board.
Yeah.
So will it be like a spin pump or
Majorana pump?
One full circle corresponds to transporting one Majorana, and another one brings the system back to its original state.
So I guess if you rotate the magnetic field, then that will really pump charge. and then that charge is pumped into the superconductor, and each, during each circle, you pump one charge, and the two myonas become shift from ion oxide to oxygen.
Yeah, because the charge is conserved in the magnet. It should be in units of electron charge, yeah. Yeah, that's a good point.
So I think if you rotate the magnetization of one of the magnets, mm-hmm. if I look at this junction, the two way I can look at, the two magnets on the top edge connected by a superconductor, and yes. the bottom edge are connected by the quantum spin Hall edge state. So yeah. if I rotate the magnetization, then on the bottom edge, I think there's this charge point, right? Yeah. On the top edge, on the bottom edge. Yeah. And on the top edge, what happens is the two myonic fermion modes, the Hamiltonian, the couple of the two myonic modes is like cosine. It's probably the coefficient probably change sign as you rotate the. I'm thinking right now that. As you rotate the magnetization,
you add one electron.
Exactly. So everything's consistent. You have one myon from one, one fermion carry change.
Yeah.
On the top edge, then you also have somehow fermion change on the bottom edge. Yeah. So the total fermion carry doesn't.
Yeah.
So it's still okay. Yeah,
that's right.
I don't see how you can pump anything with a superconducting phase again without another superconductor to measure its phase against. You can pump things by changing the relative angle of the two magnets, but not. There can't be anything happening as a function of superconducting phase, surely, because
there's a lot of
there's magnet. No other superconducting.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But you can probably do it with magnet.
The magnet, if you've got two different angles, then that's different.
Right.
But it can't possibly be in there.
But even if there is only one magnet, you can still pump charge. When you rotate the magnetic field continuously,
well, that's more than one magnet. I mean, that's the magnet all the way around.
No. So let's say if you remove the magnet on the left, then you are still pumping charge through.
Okay.
Just the fermion number parity. I mean, then in that case, we cannot say you pump between the bottom edge and the superconductor because they connect to each other.
So the H term, which carries momentum of 2kF, right? So this integral should be this anti-ferromagnet with spin density of 2kF. Why is this a uniform ferromagnetic moment?
Yeah,
it's
zero.
Yeah.
KF is zero.
This can open a gap.
Yes, it does open a gap. So there is a gap here in the magnetic edge and also here. Everything is gapped except this point. Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure that
it's so this process is not in the low energy process. So the magnet carrying is fine because they are carrying on the low energy degree of freedom. So H couples to some high energy degree of freedom.
What are the high energy degree of freedom?
If you step it from spin down to spin up, if you have the same K, the energy is different.
At the drag point.
Yeah.
The term energy is at the drag point.
Oh, at the drag point.
Yeah.
Well, in principle, there may be a momentum mismatch. In that case, it's difficult to couple. But I'm assuming that the Fermi momentum is zero in this case. Yeah, it needs some tuning. Yeah, that's right.
2kF for a couple of times. 2kF for spin density real.
Well, it won't couple that easily. There is a momentum mismatch, like in tunneling. Okay. Okay.
So if the magnets are not parallel, anti-parallel, you sure you get Majorana modes at there? Then they split and mix at the junction?
If the magnets are not parallel, like that. I suppose,
I mean, you've got three places. You can either put stuff at the junction superconductor magnet, a point at the two points at the two things, or you've got a kind of a line, because you've basically broken the topological line. You no longer have a kind of a continuous boundary that connects, that separates Z, the two different regions of topological insulator, because the magnet allows you to continuously go between the two types. The region of broken time reversal invariance means that there's a continuous path between two things. So you've really got to kind of like a smiley face with two eyes as left over the places you can put fermions into the problem, right? The kind of,
why don't you draw out a board?
I think the only places you can put fermions in at this point, if you've got left with I'm not sure. Then there's. I mean, now you've got an angle here.
That's right.
Yeah. And do these remain? I can't remember if these remain zero energy if these guys are not.
It depends on the couples we have. The only way they can not be at zero energy is if there's some tunneling between.
Yeah, it makes them split.
But if they're far apart, then that'll be.
Yeah. I can guess what happens in this case. If we think about this superconducting island, it has quantized energy levels depending on the number of electrons on that island. Mm-hmm. Actually, since there are two Majorana modes here, the charge is quantized in the units of E, not 2E. Okay. Now, if you tilt the magnetization, then there will be some offset charge.
Yeah, you pump charge. Right?
Yes.
The fermion number associated with two Majorana fermions change, and also the charge at the bottom edge also change. So the total fermion parameter, there's no problem with total fermion.
So if there's some, yeah, and if
those are the places you can add fermions anyway.
And if there's some tunneling between the fermions, then presumably the size of that, the splitting that you get between the two states of the Majoranas would be a function of the angle. And
that's right.
So tune the angle.
There's level crossing.
Yeah, and there'll be a level crossing, which is this fermion parity.
Right. Yeah.
What's the distance ratio to the width of the superconducting?
Right. So the splitting will be very small if the distance is big, right?
Yeah. Right. But if there is no tunneling, the system always remains degenerate.
Yes.
So you might mention some also, you need to consider pairing. So naturally, yeah, the pairing is amplitude, which is a special kind of fluctuation. Like, when you mention a finite time temperature, it comes from the test.
It's what was the question?
So you might imagine, so you consider interacting systems, all the parameters here that be fluctuating. So you have to change the sign dynamically.
So
superconducting is 3D.
Yeah,
superconducting is 3D. Yeah. So you consider it's a one-dimensional pairings that you.
No.
The pairings induced.
It's a proximity.
Yeah. Yeah. So you have a big classical superconductor.
Mm. Okay, so.
Oh, yeah. So the microphone. Oh.
Okay. So I'll just give a very short talk. Much of the material has been covered earlier, first of all, I wanted to thank the organizers for this workshop and for inviting me to talk here, and also want to mention, this work was done independently, but I benefited a lot from Michael Stone, Xu Cheng, and Sheldon Katz. I learned about many of these things from a visit to Stanford and from talking to Professor Zhang.
Who is Sheldon Katz?
He's a mathematician and a string theorist in Urbana.
Yeah, it's actually interesting. So Rahul's mathematician evidently talked to my mathematician. It sort of went over our heads.
Who's your mathematician?
My mathematician is Tony Panta. They're friends, and they have their high level.
So we have unfair disadvantage.
Actually, the thing is, I guess a similar thing happened with Charlie Kane, but when I asked Professor Katz about this thing, and I formulated it in a mathematical way so that he could understand, he immediately told me the answer in all dimensions. I mean, not immediately, but...
he wrote to Tony Panta first.
But he gave the answer in D equal to 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and it involves them, yeah. So things which I couldn't understand, so that helped me motivated. So it's based on these works, and I hope that that one of them is will be in Annals of Physics soon. So this one's in PRB. This is an earlier work which is not directly related, but it's connected. Just want to give an overview to people who. To define this topological superconductor, first of all, I just want to make some comments about that. This is valid in the mean field picture, at least so far. So one way of understanding it is that you can write down the BCS wave function, and you can say that it's annihilated by these operators, and these are negative energy eigenvectors of a mean field BDG Hamiltonian. So now, if you look at these things represent now wave functions in momentum space, and you can define a fiber bundle in momentum space. So basically the meaning of this slide is that you can map these superconductors onto insulators, and so you can take over the classification from the insulators here. And so you can obtain a topological classification of superconductors of time over supersymmetry. So I actually broke this down into two things, which is probably trivial to most people, especially now that we know a little bit about this analysis. But so superconductors, if you think about them as having broken translational symmetry due to some lattices, the topological classification you would naively think is the same as that of insulators. In superfluid, something interesting happens. So if you remember my earlier talk, I had given a talk on constructing the Z2 invariant in two dimensions in terms of an obstruction. So I viewed it as some sort of a monopole in momentum space. In 3D, I didn't use that route. I actually looked at various 2D cross sections, and I defined the Z2 invariant in that way. So then one can ask, is there a different way of obtaining the 3D Z2 invariant? And in fact, there is. So in superfluids, you can have a one-point compactification of momentum space. So what this means is that momentum space, if you imagine that the Fermi liquid picture underlying the superconductor is valid at all k, which technically it's not, but for a moment if you grant me that, then it's one can assert that as you go to very large k, the wave functions, which are the negative energy eigenfunctions of the BDG Hamiltonian, they will be uniform. So there'll be no Berry curvature associated with this vector space for very large k. So you can compactify it by identifying it as one point. And so your momentum space essentially becomes S2 in two dimensions and S3 in three dimensions. And what that does is that if you look at the Z2 classification, it becomes, it doesn't change in 2D, but in 3D, you get a single Z2 invariant. And this Z2 invariant is nice because it corresponds to the one which determines whether there's a strong topological insulator or weak topological insulator. So it's a nice way of understanding that particular invariant. And also, if you look at a toy model, or if you look at the quintessential example of a 3D Z2 insulator, you can actually work out 3D Z2 superfluid, you can actually work out the edge states explicitly. So that's another nice feature. And you can show that, well, as I'll be discussing a little bit later, you can show that. So you remember that there was this Dirac cones in an insulator. In a superfluid, the Dirac cone moves to the Fermi energy. And that's another nice feature of the superfluids. But I should say that you know, a more complete description has been obtained by Shinsei and Professor Ludwig and others, and also Alexei Kitaev. So in 3D, there's actually a Z invariant, which is also mentioned by Taylor. I want to discuss triplet superconductors because they provide nice examples of these topological phenomena, whether you think of them as insulators or superfluids. You can just imagine that I can write down some Hamiltonian like this with some number of fermion species, and this could be either an insulator or a... This could be some insulator, a theoretical insulator with no translational breaking, with no lattice, if you wish, which is always gapped in some sense, but momentum space is not torus. But in the case of helium-3b, you actually have an order parameter which can be written in this form. It's a triplet superfluid, so you have these three parameters, and this is the d vector notation. And if you write it in this form, it turns out that you can just write down a very simple form for a two-dimensional superfluid, which is a two-dimensional analog of helium-3b, and this is equivalent to p plus ip spin up times p minus ip spin down. So, as was pointed out by Professor Zhang, the quantum spin Hall effect in graphene is two copies of or at least the original quantum spin Hall effect proposed by Kaelin and Lee was two copies of Haldane's model on a honeycomb lattice, essentially that. And so the topological superconductor here is simply two copies of a chiral spinless P plus IP superconductor. Now this has some nice properties which follow immediately from this identification. Now if you think about these, you can have these vortices which don't break time reversal symmetry. You can have an up vortex here and a down vortex here. But this actually doesn't couple to the U1 gauge field. It couples to a gauge field which rotates this B vector in K space. And then the zero mode in these vortices is protected by Cramer's theorem. So as I said, the spin vortex may be thought of as composed of two vortices of opposite vorticity for each spin. It's a physical superposition of these two vortices. And, you know, the spin vortex then has a pair of Majorana fermions.
Is there any gauge field actually that couples to gauge field B?
Well, so it's a physical gauge field, no. I guess you could think about it in terms of a rotation of the D vector itself, and so you could probably couple it to a SU2 sort of gauge field, which might change the rotation of D. So I know that something like that can be thought about in helium-3a. That's actually one of the things that I looked at with Krishnendu. You get, in fact, some sort of a Hopf term, which has to do with... But yes, you can think about an SU2 gauge field which couples to the rotation of D.
Yeah, but our U1 wouldn't,
yeah. Which is nice because then, you know, you realize that it doesn't break time reversal symmetry. So in 3D, well, helium-3b has this vector, and frankly, this is something that excited me a lot when I found it because, you know, there was a lot of excitement about actually finding topological insulators in 2D and 3D. So by symmetry, as I was arguing, if you forget about the Leggett angle and certain things which are peculiar to helium-3b, this state would be degenerate with a set of states where d of k is r times k. So this is in the d vector notation. D of k is simply k, but you can rotate it by a fixed rotation where r belongs to SO3. And then this has a fundamental group of Z2. I don't know if this Z2 is very fundamental to the Z2 that we see in the superfluid itself. But it turns out that there are only two types of defects here. And so these defects can be thought of in this form, and if you actually explicitly work out what happens to this defect, you can see that if you impose periodic boundary conditions, you actually get zero energy modes.
Has this kind of defect been observed or not?
Yeah, so actually I always assume that after talking to Tony Leggett, I realized that these will be pretty expensive in energy because you have spin currents and you have gradients of these terms. But actually last year I talked to Miniv, and then Sukpum also recently pointed out that you can, instead of deforming the vector continuously in R space, you can actually keep it pretty much constant and then you can have a narrow texture. And this texture could be close to a boundary, and this sort of configuration would not be that expensive in energy. And actually, Sukpum would be able to tell about a certain experiment which was interpreted as indicating the presence of such a spin mass vortex.
Yeah, there was this experiment with rotating helium 3B, and they detected some first order phase transition at high pressure. And there has been claimed that this is actually a signature of formation of these kind of spin vortices.
Yeah. Okay, so so there's going to be a stable pair of Majorana modes in the vortex under certain conditions. And
so when you talk about the previous slide is 3D, right? It's about three dimensional.
Yes.
So the vortex is really a vortex line.
Yes. Yeah. If we can meet, yeah. So and there are different ways of understanding this, the fact that this phase is topological. I mean, if you just naively think that there's two Majorana fermions, it could be accidental, and then you form a Dirac fermion, and then it's not interesting anymore. But actually, it's topological, and the Cramer's theorem prevents them from opening up a gap. So this Dirac fermion has something topological about it. It's not like an S-wave state where if you have two zero-energy states, then it's not protected. And so I think the right way of thinking about it is that if you somehow restrict yourself, let's think about the 2D case. You restrict yourself to the upspin sector, and then you do any of these braiding operations, then you'll find that the statistics of the upspins as a whole, as alone, is non-abelian. Okay? So it's non-abelian statistics in each sector. I don't know if there's actual physical experiments which could distinguish, you know, or you could constrain yourself, restricting yourself to one sector. But the other thing I want to point out is that actually these systems will also support the half quantum vortices of helium 3A. So you can have a vortex in only the upspin sector and nothing in the downspin, and that will obviously have a single Majorana mode. That will not be a time reversal protected or... that will not be a time reversal invariant state. That will be actually a U1 vortex, but you could have such a vortex. Presumably, it will be costly in energy, but that would have a normal Majorana mode. So another way of thinking about this non-local entanglement is the way that Taylor pointed out, is that the fermionic occupation of vortex cores changes when vortices are circled around each other. And so the long-distance correlation / quantum entanglement is a signature of the topological order. It's topological in the same sense that you can't have a single vortex, and when you have two of them, they're certainly entangled in a strong way. So in the context of search for new topological insulators, it's, you know, nice to know that a system that we've known for quite a while, for 20 or 30 years, is actually a topological superfluid in the same sense of topological, in the sense that the single particle picture of it has this nice band structure properties, it's a nice fiber bundle or topological properties. The nice thing, as I said, the edge state spectrum can be worked out exactly, and this actually reduces to the first problem that I did in grad school. You can calculate the edge state spectrum explicitly, and you can see that it's actually proportional to root over kx squared plus ky squared. So, that's it pretty much.
Thank you.